Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Listen, you have no idea how much stands between you and a small, small, very easily climbed paywall. That paywall consists of just a less than you pay for a cup of coffee each week. You can go and listen to the full 3-hour program every week and get access to our archives, which has over 10 years of shows. Come on, folks. If you like what you're listening now, you're going to love being a member. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. Either way, enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, journalist Daniel Jute will be here to discuss his cover story from The Nation magazine, Australia's devastating wildfires were not inevitable. Progressive Senate candidate Andrew Romanoff will join us to discuss his race for Senate in Colorado and why the seat is essential if we want to flip the Senate. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the big news stories from this week. And investigative journalist Mike Ludwig will be here to explain how unsafe levels of the chemical PFAS made it into almost every city's drinking water in the U.S. Are you listening to one of our radio affiliates right now? Well, you should know that there's a free 1-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire and hear the entire 3-hour radio show commercial-free by going to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. That's ROFpodcast.com. Help me run down the most important stories of this week. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, obviously a crazy week in the news, a lot of stuff going on. We can choose from, why don't we take the story that probably has wrapped up more or less, and that is, of course, impeachment, although it remains to be seen if it's a story, and I would imagine it's going to be for Cory Gardner and for Martha McSally and for maybe Loeffler if she's and Perdue in Georgia, or could be Collins in Georgia. We could be talking about this in regards to Susan Collins come November. We could be talking about this in regards to Tom Tillis and Joni Ernst. And that is impeachment, which is officially now a bipartisan vote to convict Donald Trump. It didn't pass, but the impetus to convict him for his impeachment was bipartisan because of Mitt Romney.
Absolutely, and you know you can't get really, you know, you can't get past the symbolic nature of that particular person being the one to do it. Now, you know, I mean, we all know the reality. Mitt Romney's from Utah, and he's safe there, and he's not running for re-election, and he could do this for any number of reasons. I guess some people could say it's some kind of sour grapes as well. I'm sure the right-wingers are. But the fact remains that Mitt Romney is the last Republican nominee for president. I mean, he's the last one who ran before Donald Trump. For him to be the one to cross over, I think that's heavily symbolic of the sort of Rubicon that the Republican Party in general has crossed over. That what you see is this cult of personality, and it's highly authoritarian. Some would say neo-fascist. I'm going to say it. And you know, this the fact that the last guy they chose to be their standard bearer is the last man standing in the Republican Party, in the official Republican establishment, to stand up and say, no, this guy obviously committed high crimes and misdemeanors. And what he said in his speech is really interesting, because he said, you know, I'm going to be vilified for this, and I know it. I know that I'm going to be absolutely taken to task, but I couldn't live with myself. You know, my conscience, my God, or whatever. He had a much more erudite quote than what I'm saying. But, you know, it was meaningful because he was saying, look, I am totally on the wrong side of my party, and I know it. I know what is going to happen to me. I know how they're going to react. And, of course, you know, they did. And, you know, what that says, I mean, I think it just makes it so clear about where the Republican Party has gone. And now you and I, of course, know that this has been a long time coming. We've talked about it. Romney played a role in that. I mean, he's not, yep, you know, an innocent party. But unlike most of the rest of them, I shouldn't say most of them, there are people who have, you know, sort of done their mea culpas and said, you know, yes, we know what we did, whatever. But for the most part, they've all gone along with it. And for the few of them, and particularly in elected office, which is really shocking to me. I mean, some of these people are in safe seats.
Well,
they have nothing
really
to fear.
Not just particularly. Like, I think Romney's the only elected Republican who has bucked him on any level.
He is?
Really.
Justin Amash had to leave the party for bucking,
yep,
it. I mean, he left. There was no hope for him. He knew it. He had to go become an independent. I mean, this is, I mean, the authoritarian strain that you see at work right out in the open on this. I mean, they threaten people who don't go along with the Trump party line. And it is right there. It is out there for us to see. And, you know, I think that this has been made very, very clear. I mean, the impeachment, I don't know, maybe the American people are going to vote that they really want, you know, fascism. Maybe that's really what's going to happen next November. Or maybe, you know, the vote will be stolen and everybody will just go, well, heck, that's the way it goes. But no one can say that you can't see what it is now, that it isn't perfectly obvious. They aren't trying to hide it. It's right out in plain sight that these people will excuse anything that Donald Trump does. They will go along with whatever he says, that there will be no dissent within the Republican Party. And if you are going to, if you're going to be anyone who does it, you're going to be alone. And you're going to have to be prepared to face the consequences. And we've seen it before with others. But with Romney, I mean, this is a crucible. You know, this is the real vote. And he will never recover, I don't think, his, you know, former stature. He put his entire legacy on the line. And I think he's talking to history now. He's not talking to his own career. He's, you know, he's older. He's not going to run again. I mean, he doesn't have to run again. Let's just put it that way.
Well,
so,
what's interesting is for the first time this week, I believe it was the first time this week, Donald Trump became, his unfavorables were actually not upside down, as it were, in Utah this week. The first time it happened this week a majority of Utah voters approve of Donald Trump. And so, you know, credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
Romney, I think probably, I don't know if he thinks that's a temporary thing. And like you say, maybe he's just not worried about running again. You know, his father was very much bucked the Republican Party at the time on civil rights. And to be honest with you, I've never seen Mitt Romney rise to that level of sort of a principle and whatnot. But I think he made a calculation. He said, I'm probably not going to be president unless something radically changes with the Republican Party. And if it does, then I will not pay for this vote in the way that I anticipate doing. And I think he just decided. And you know, he said, with my vote, this is the quote, with my vote, I will tell my children and their children that I did my duty to the best of my ability, believing that my country expected of me. And, you know, you got to give the guy some credit for doing that, because he is effectively ending his career as a Republican, Republican lawmaker.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he will continue on. He doesn't have to run for re-election for another 4 years. Maybe they'll forget by then. I doubt it, but possibly. But yeah, I mean, good for him, because this does really rob Trump of a major talking point. We got to take a quick break. Let's come back. We'll talk about that. Because also, I think there was a reason why Mitch McConnell did not want to hold this vote over, you know, on Friday or Saturday of this past week, I guess, when he could have. We'll talk more about impeachment we've got, of course, are going to talk about the fiasco that was the Iowa caucus and the implications of who came out of there as a winner and who came out of there as a big, big loser. And then, of course, we still have a lot more to talk about, all the news this week. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with the great Digby. Hey, folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby. So, Heather, we've got a lot to talk about, obviously, on this week's show. We've got the impeachment vote. We've got the 2020 elections, and we get the State of the Union. Also, we got to touch on the Trump decision to essentially begin the process of cutting Medicaid for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans across the country. But we're still talking impeachment. We're talking Mitt Romney. Because that's really the big deal here, right? I mean, everybody anticipated that you might lose a Democrat or two, you know, or they might split their votes. Doug Jones was a surprise. He came out strong. Here's a guy who's running for re-election, maybe in trouble. You know, Manchin and Sinema, not. But Doug Jones running for re-election, and he came out and he said, I'm going to vote for impeachment on both counts. Very strong. But Mitt Romney, he was the one taking a big, big risk, and, you know, maybe he just decided it's not worth it for me and my family. Maybe he's not enjoying being a senator. Maybe he thinks that they're going to lose the Senate in 2020, and, you know, he's going to be a minority senator. He doesn't want to live with that vote. So he voted to convict, and that really robs Donald Trump of, I think, what was going to be a big talking point. Now, if you had asked me, last week, I guess, Friday, when they had voted to have no witnesses, why Mitch McConnell is not having this vote to convict on Friday night or Saturday night, he could have. He could have done it on Monday, right, during the primary. I would have said, I don't think they want Donald Trump to be able to go out on that Super Bowl interview and on the State of the Union and brag about having not been convicted, because maybe they don't want to talk about impeachment that much. Maybe they don't want the American public to know that it happened. And because, you know, people forget that, like, you know, you and I, we just assume like everybody's on top of impeachment. But, you know, people forget, like, even the grabber by the you-know-what tape got submerged in some respects by the Comey letter. Like, you know, the media is the media. And the Super Bowl and the State of the Union, the two places that you know Fox viewers are watching and those people who might be swing votes in purple states are watching. And so they may have wanted to smirch that. Now I'm starting to think that maybe Mitt Romney had told Mitch McConnell on Friday, like, ain't happening for me, man. I'm going to vote to convict. And maybe McConnell didn't want the president to deal with those things for the State of the Union and for the interview. And so,
well, I think you're right.
I mean, right. It could go either way, but no, go ahead. I mean, what's your thoughts?
Well, I absolutely think you're right, because look at what he did do in that interview with Sean Hannity. I mean, he was, you know, just an insulting, puerile, you know, rally talking points in front of that gigantic audience of his. And, of course, the State of the Union, which we'll talk about in a little while, was equally so. It wasn't quite as crude, but, you know, basically it was a red meat speech for his followers. So Mitch may very well have thought, you know, geez, let's just keep this thing on the down low and keep everybody guessing on the vote until afterwards so that we don't get him all riled up. You know, they treat him like a toddler. And I will say one thing else about Romney that I think is important is that he has presented an argument to the challengers of all these Republican senators who are up in vulnerable states. Because people are going to come up and go, you know, look, here's somebody with some integrity over here. This guy, you know, acted on principle. Mitt Romney, the former GOP nominee for president, just, you know, 7 years ago, he was the guy. And he came out and voted. These people, Susan Collins and Cory Gardner and Martha McSally and Joni Ernst and all these people, they didn't have, they couldn't summon up the courage to actually make a vote on a matter of principle like this. They couldn't do it. I think it's a potent argument. I think Romney's given them sort of a symbol, kind of a McCain-like thing, right, where they can say, I mean, I know it's kind of sickening. Romney's no hero, no progressive hero by any means. But in this instance, he serves a purpose to sort of show that that it's possible that you could have done this and you could have stood on principle. You could have carried that around with you. You could have been the John McCain or the, you know, now the Mitt Romney or whomever it is, instead of a toady for Donald Trump. So I think Romney gave the Democrats, the Senate Democrats, a gift.
Another
argument to make.
Without a doubt, he is the first U.S. senator in American history to vote to remove a president of his own party. And and I think, frankly, you know, you could have picked any senator. It could have been Murkowski, for that matter.
Could have.
And it still would have been like, you know, you have taken away the talking point that the president and, you know, Martha McSally, like you say, or Tom Tillis or Cory Gardner or Susan Collins. I mean, Susan Collins, the fact that Mitt Romney did it and she didn't is going to be a problem for her. You've taken away their talking point that this is just a partisan impeachment. You know, that's the thing is it is. And you know, I you and I both get very annoyed at the concept of, you know, well, you had three members of the House of the Democrats who voted with Republicans on this bill, and that does not make it a bipartisan bill.
Right.
But what it does do is it says, like, it's just not knee-jerk partisanship. Because now that Utah is actually has a net favorable for Donald Trump, right? Like, you can't even say it's just politically cynical for this guy. It really is this is a blunt, maybe not even that blunt of an instrument for anybody who's challenging a Republican senator in 2020. And there's half a dozen of them at least who are in big problems. You know, I can tell you right now off the top of my head, Cory Gardner is in a state with a negative 14 favorability rating for Donald Trump. When you start moving to like places like, you know, Arizona and Georgia and Maine is minus 6 points. Arizona, Georgia, you're talking about 2 or 4 negative points. You get to Tom Tillis, 0. It's tied, basically, right? I mean, in terms of favorability ratings. So these senators are in some trouble. And Mitt Romney just basically gave their challengers, their Democratic challengers, a bat. And I think they're going to use it. But we got to take a we got to take a break. We'll be back in the next hour. Digby, if you'll join me, we got to talk 2020. And I'm not talking about the senators. I'm talking about those who are running for president. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, the dangerous chemical that is now in almost every drinking water supply in the country. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Recent report from the Environmental Working Group detailed the amount of contamination caused by the chemical PFAS, 44 locations around 31 states. Here to discuss the results and how the nation's drinking water supply has become highly contaminated, Mike Ludwig, Truth Out. So, Mike, let's start with the obvious question. What is a PFAS? And I should say it's PFAS, but it's P-F-A-S. What is a PFAS?
Well, I just kind of say PFAS for short, but these are per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. I can hardly say it, but they're basically industrial chemicals that have been used for a variety of different products, and they used to be used in household products, but no longer, that are like surfactants. The best example is Teflon. Your food slides right off it, right? And they have this kind of effect on the viscosity of liquids and things that can be used for a bunch of different stuff, most notoriously in Teflon and 3M Scotchgard in the example of two products. There's also hundreds more that are used in firefighting foam and a variety of industrial uses.
Now, my understanding is that this stuff, okay, so some of it is actually used, some of it is actually in these products, and some of it was used to make these products, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are industries that use this in manufacturing. There's also types of PFAS chemicals that are put on food packaging because it prevents things from sticking to the package. There's two notorious ones, PFOS and PFOA, and those were used in Teflon and 3M Scotchgard. Those are no longer in use because of widespread contamination near the areas where they are manufactured and also health concerns about having them in the home. So the federal government has phased those two out, basically by putting pressure on the industry for years. The industry has also faced a number of lawsuits near their manufacturing plants.
In fact, DuPont, I mean, we've talked about the case involving C8 and DuPont. Mike Papantonio's firm did the actual trial work on that, where DuPont was manufacturing Teflon using C8, which I believe was a PFAS or at least some derivative of it. And they were using it to make Teflon. And 3M, which originally produced it and sold it to DuPont, basically got out of the business because they knew this stuff would not go away. And it said they needed to be burned. And instead, DuPont basically started to dump it out in like some tributary to the Ohio River, I guess. And the problem with that is not only is it toxic at certain levels, highly toxic in some instances, is that it doesn't go away. Will you explain that concept of a forever chemical? Because this is something that I think most people are not fully aware of.
Right. They call them forever chemicals because they are so persistent, not only in the environment, but in the human body. That means they just refuse, these compounds basically refuse to break down over time. And that's why we're seeing such widespread contamination, even at very low levels. Once it gets released into the environment, it doesn't go away because it doesn't decompose like an organic compound would. It just sticks around. So if you eat something with this chemical on it, it could stay in your body for a very long period of time. In fact, some experts say that almost everyone in the United States probably has trace amounts of these chemicals in their body.
Wow. And do we have a sense of like, and it has to do with like the molecular structure of this chemical, right? Like there's too many carbon bonds or something to that effect. I mean, I don't want to pretend like I know anything about science, but that's my understanding, is that there's the molecular structure is such that it just doesn't break down over time.
Yeah, I'm not a chemist, but I do understand how pollution works just from reporting on it across the country. And because these things don't break down, if it gets into a river and that river flows to the lake, it's going to stay in the lake. If it gets into rainwater, that rain could spread it everywhere because it's not going anywhere. I mean, and it's because of the way that they're structured. And, you know, the industry had concerns about this a long time ago, but didn't say anything. This ended up being something that independent researchers and for instance, the case that you talked about, this is stuff that came out through the process of lawsuits and environmentalists looking into it. And essentially researchers are saying, hey, we're going to research this and see what the problem is.
And so we have this chemical that has been, like you say, and I think it was Dark Waters. If people want to go check out that film, basically recounted the story of a derivative of this chemical and the cases against it. And it's a lifelong, you know, it's an age old story of these corporations basically privatizing the profits from the use of this chemical and then socializing the cost by basically dumping it into our rivers, dumping it into our soil and dumping it essentially into our bodies without obviously our permission. How do researchers have a sense of how this got into our bodies? I mean, is it from using the products? Is it from eating, you know, you talk about it going into a lake. Is it from eating the fish that go in there? I mean, what are the different ways in which this chemical makes it into our systems?
A lot of it has to do with water. Actually, there is legislation in Congress that would require industries to report when they release these chemicals into municipal sewer systems. Right now, there's no federal rules preventing an industrial facility from just letting these chemicals into the municipal water treatment of their local area. Now, across the Midwest, this is just one example, across the Midwest, sewer sludge is actually used as a treatment or a fertilizer on industrial fields. Now, if that sewer sludge has PFAS in it, maybe because people were at some time using it in the household and it was going down the sink, or because there was an industrial release either into the water supply that then ended up in the sewer or directly into the municipal sewer system, rain will come and wash that waste into a tributary, which will go into a stream, which will go into the Mississippi River, and impact all of our watersheds. And this most recent study that I have been reporting on suggests that most surface sources of drinking water, lakes, rivers, streams in the United States are likely contaminated at this point because, like we said, the stuff just doesn't go away. It just moves around. And water is probably one of the easiest ways for it to move around.
That's amazing. So when we talk about these chemicals and we're talking about a wide array of these sort of chemicals that are similarly structured, how do we have a sense that they're in all of our drinking supply?
So this is based on a few different studies, and I'll go through all three of them.
I'll tell you what, Mike, let's do this. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about these three studies, which are basically laying out evidence that all of our drinking supplies is contaminated in some way by these forever chemicals. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Mike Ludwig from Truth Out. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to Mike Ludwig from Truth Out about his piece, quote, virtually all major U.S. drinking water sources likely contaminated with PFAS. Mike, in the last segment, you basically walked us through these PFAS or PFAS or PFAS, which is a class or a family of drugs, which, not drugs, rather, chemicals, which, because of the way they're structured, do not break down in nature. They do not have a half-life, or to the extent that they have one, it is super, super long. And so they, when they get dumped into a river, or when they get washed off of a field, when they make it into any type of water, they just travel until they land. Maybe they land in a fish, or maybe they land in your faucet, and they end up in the human body. And you were telling us about the most recent study, which shows that basically, you know, more or less, all of our drinking supply is contaminated in some way by these forever chemicals. You were about to tell us about three different ways in which they were measuring this. Tell us.
Well, the most recent study took basically a random sampling of large cities, small towns, and it's just testing of their tap water. And these are locations all over the country, Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, Birmingham, Alabama, New Orleans, where I live. Also small towns like Bergen County, New Jersey, which is a suburb, or Brunswick County in North Carolina, which is a rural area. And so they did a sampling of these of all these places. And of the 44 places where they took tap water samples, 43 came back positive for some level of PFAS in the drinking water. This is water that comes out of the tap. The only place that did not come back positive was Meridian, Mississippi, where the water for that municipal system is drawn from wells that are very deep below the ground. Everywhere else, like where I live in New Orleans, the water comes from a surface source, a lake or a river. In the case of my community, that would be the Mississippi River. Or in Louisville, Kentucky, that would be the Ohio River. So the fact that the only place tested that didn't have any detectable PFAS in it was the one place that had water coming from very deep wells that weren't directly fed by tributaries or river stream suggests that this is a widespread phenomenon all over the country, particularly with surface sources of drinking water. There's also been independent research on these chemicals in rainwater that found it to be widespread. And the EPA has done its own review. Although it wasn't extensive, they found evidence of PFAS in cities across the country impacting up to, I believe, 100 million people with those water supplies. Now, the researchers behind this most recent study, the Environmental Working Group, say that their data suggests that it could even be more widespread than that, particularly since every single location that had a drinking source that was a surface source, like a river or lake, came back positive.
So once we determine that this is in all our drinking water, and then thus, like you say, probably in all of our bodies, What are the implications of that? I mean, how much of this do we need to ingest before we start having problems? I mean, I know just from talking to Mike Papantonio and other lawyers associated with that C8 case, which was a PFAS case or a PFAS chemical, that within a certain radius of the manufacturing plant where DuPont had dumped this chemical, you had over 3,500 people with some form of malady that was a function of exposure to this stuff. Do we have a sense of like how toxic it is and, you know, how much you need inside your body for that toxicity to manifest itself?
Right. Now, this is the gray area that scientists are still working on, and it's also the area where the industry can inject a lot of its spin into the media because it gets really complicated really fast. Now, from the case that you're talking about with the C8 and Parkersburg, West Virginia, where people in a localized area were exposed to really high levels of this stuff, we know from research on them and their bodies and their maladies that PFAS can increase the risk of cancer. It can harm the development of the fetus in the womb. It can reduce the effectiveness of vaccines and also have impacts on the liver and the immune system. So we know that, but to what levels does it reach a danger threshold? And that's really tough to tell. The EPA has really only looked at the two most notorious ones, PFAS and PFOA, right? Those are DuPont and 3M's famous chemicals. Now, the EPA set a non-enforceable, that means this really has no weight of law behind it, limit for those two at 70 parts per trillion. But that's only two of them, right? And this is a class of up to 600 compounds. There is a debate among scientists whether the other ones are just as dangerous, particularly the ones that are currently being used in food packaging, right? They're related to these dangerous chemicals, but there hasn't been the research yet to show us whether they're actually dangerous or not. So scientists right now are scrambling to figure all this out. The Environmental Working Group suggests that actually the threshold, the health limit should be one part per trillion for all of these, for the entire family, not just the two that the EPA is saying. So it really is a huge debate. Now, of course, if the
EPA is saying, I'm not a math whiz, but the EPA is saying you can have 70 times more than activists are saying is healthy. Well, that's quite a wide disparity. It doesn't look like the EPA. What's going on with the EPA? Are they just not able to sort of pick up on the science? Are they getting pressure? What's the story?
They're absolutely under pressure, and they're actually facing a really big problem. If they start making enforceable limits for this stuff, that means they're going to have to start enforcing the law. That means that companies might be required to clean up this pollution. That would be very expensive for the private companies. It also means municipal water systems might have to install really expensive filtration technology to keep this out of our tap water. Actually fixing this problem is going to take a lot of money that nobody really wants to spend. And that explains why Democrats in the House were able to pass sweeping legislation to address this that would require the EPA to set an enforceable limit within 2 years and then start the process of cleaning up the whole country. And it would also hold the polluters to account and force them to pay into paying to clean this up. Now, the Trump administration has threatened to veto this, and the Senate Republicans refuse to pick it up because they know that it would require spending a huge amount of money and it would have a huge impact on private industry. So instead, they have their own PFAS action plan at the EPA. Unfortunately, it's just not moving along fast enough. Basically, the last I checked, they had submitted a proposal to consider a classification for these substances that is now under interagency review. Basically, if you had talked to environmentalists, the bureaucracy is dragging its feet while the problem gets worse and worse.
Okay. And so and what is the name of that bill? Do you know what that bill in the House is so people can follow it?
Right. The bill is the PFAS Action Act of 2019. And there's other legislation, too. Like I said, there's also a bill that would require the industry to notify the government where they're putting these chemicals into our municipal water supply. At this point, you can just send these, wastewater contaminated with this stuff to the local wastewater treatment plant without saying anything about it.
And the wastewater,
there might be local regulations that prevent that. But on the federal level, there's nothing to stop it.
That's nuts. All right. Well, listen, we just have about 45 seconds left. If I'm hearing this and I'm at home and I've got, I've got my kids or I drink a lot of water from my tap because I think the tap water is good. What do I do? I mean, is there something? Is there a filter? What do I do?
The Environmental Working Group says that a reverse osmosis filters work best. Those are more expensive. Carbon filters will also help, but maybe aren't as effective. Probably, if you're really worried about it, combining reverse osmosis and carbon filter would be the best way to ensure that your water is completely clear of this stuff. But like I said, you know, some of the concentrations here are really low, and it's so unclear at this point what the health danger is, and that might be one reason why it's so scary.
Mike Ludwig, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Ludwig is a staff reporter at Truthout. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.